Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kallik, and this is Dispatches. After 6 months of nonstop horrors in Gaza, the live-streamed apocalypse Israel has imposed on over 2 million Palestinians trapped there keeps getting worse. It's so bad, we're running out of words to explain what Israel's doing in Gaza. Genocide seems too soft a description. Meanwhile, the axis of genocide, led by the U.S., continues to mow down international law, make excuses for all of Israel's worst crimes, and send more weapons to ensure the extermination continues. And the media and U.S. spokespeople keep insulting our intelligence by trying to convince us that the victims are the perpetrators and must act in accordance to the sensitivities of their oppressors. To discuss this and more, I'm joined by Asl Rad, who has a PhD in modern Middle East history and is the author of State of Resistance: Politics, Culture, and Identity in Modern Iran. But before we jump into it, this is just part of this episode. The full interview is available to Breakthrough News members only. You can become a member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. Asl, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me. We have so much to talk about. And this is actually, welcome back to the show, because you came on a couple of years ago and we had a lengthy discussion about Iran. So after people are done watching this episode, go and check out the last one we did. But this time we're going to be talking about some tangentially related issues surrounding the horrific, I mean, I don't even know what to call it anymore. I started calling it apocalypse, but like it's a man-made apocalypse in Gaza that Israel's created. And I mean, I think a good place to start is you wrote a piece recently. The title is "The U.S. is Destroying the International System Along with Gaza." And in it, you argue that it's time, and I'm reading the subheading here, it's time to act or to reassess the institutions and the governments that make international humanitarian laws futile. And I think that this is an important point that sometimes gets lost in everything taking place right now, is the complete like destruction, erosion of this international system of laws that every single day Israel violates, probably every single one. I actually don't think that's an exaggeration. I mean, just you, as we're recording this, I think it was just the day before yesterday, the Israelis intentionally, even though they say it was unintentionally based on their actions, they hit a convoy 3 times of aid workers and killed 7 people trying to deliver food to hungry Palestinians in Gaza who are being subjected to an intentional famine. They had just withdrawn from El Shifa Hospital, which they spent 2 weeks completely destroying, summarily executing people, committing horrors I'm sure we haven't even, you know, heard back about yet, just killing doctors, killing, I mean, just entire family. It's insane, demolishing all of the buildings. And they also bombed the, I think it was like the consular building of the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus, which, you know, they've bombed and killed Iranian officials, leaders, military officials in Syria before, but the targeting, the specific location of this being attached to an embassy, which is supposed to be off limits, another violation of international law. So all that's to say, I mean, going back to your piece, can you kind of like briefly outline what your argument is here and why it's so important to be, you know, to focus on the erosion of international law?
Yeah, well, there was two elements to that particular piece. One was the fact that when we talk about Gaza, there's this tendency in the Western narratives to separate Gaza from the West Bank or from the Palestinian diaspora, the refugee population without the right of return, right? Or from East Jerusalem. Like all of these pieces are compartmentalized. And one of the things that I noticed in Western coverage, and I understand why they do it, right? They refer to Palestinians in Gaza as Gazans. The problem is when you never refer to them as Palestinians, it starts to erase that identity. And that is something that has been the strategy of Israel for decades. And so in the West, by emulating those narratives, we basically serve the Israeli strategy of erasing that identity and of making these separate issues. They're not. They're all consumed under one issue, and that is occupation, right? The occupation of Palestinian lands, apartheid in the West Bank, decades of oppression, decades of Palestinians not having self-determination, equal rights, And so all of it falls under this idea of Palestinian liberation. And why I bring that up is because that context is so often missing in the Western narrative. And the way that even we talk about it in international law, when we're talking about it in, okay, so why is this linked to international law? Because you can't compartmentalize it there either, right? So Israel's war crimes in Gaza are not separate from its detentions of children in the West Bank, from killing Palestinians in the West Bank, from expanding settlements, from sanctioning settler violence, right? All of these things are connected because it is an overall system that is oppressing an entire people. And that's why it's so important to understand all of it together. It all has to be addressed at the same time, right? Even if you have a ceasefire in Gaza, if you go back to the status quo, you still go back to occupation, you still go back to blockade, you still go back to settlements. And all of that is still illegal under international law. So really what's happened with Gaza is the actions of Israel are so egregious, so atrocious, that it's brought global attention in a way that has not been on the Palestinian issue, I would say at least since the early 2000s when we saw the Second Intifada. But remember, if you go back to the early 2000s, that's before social media. That's before, I mean, you had the internet, but it wasn't, people weren't connected on their devices, right? You couldn't live stream atrocities to your phone everywhere you go, right? Now people are connected in a very different way. And social media is allowing people to see things that Western and mainstream narratives would never show you. And you never would have seen it during the early 2000s, during the Second Intifada, but now we're seeing it. So that's why I think we're also witnessing a shift in not only how people are talking about the issue of Palestine, the issue of Palestinian liberation, and not only how they're talking about Israel, but how they're talking about the United States and how they're talking about the international system as a whole. So what's the problem? One thing to caveat is the argument in the piece is not that we had such an efficient international system before now. Like, this international system has not worked well really since its inception because of the way it was designed and because of the context it was designed in, right? So you had like the fact that we have five permanent members that gives disproportionate power to five countries in a system that's supposed to bring equity within the international order, right? So it has flaws, but just like any other system, right? We have democracies that are deeply, deeply flawed. But the point is we still have those systems, right? You could criticize democracy in the United States and say, this is a deeply, deeply flawed system. But what happens when we start to lose even the flawed system and it gives way to an entirely different one? And that's the argument that I'm making with the international system. Not that it was working really well, but at least the idea of it was meaningful. And that's what I think is happening now. The meaning of it is being entirely stripped. It's being laid bare in a way that I don't think we've really seen, to the point where it does not matter what Israel does. It just doesn't matter what they do. To the point where they're possibly committing genocide, and it still doesn't matter. Everything is treated as if Israel has complete impunity to act however it wants. And that is a really frightening point to find ourselves in.
It does. It really does seem that way. That it's, I mean, it's like every day since October 8th, I feel like I've woken up being like, oh yeah, there's no way it can be worse than what they did yesterday. And it is. It doesn't stop. It's like some days there's so many things that happen. It's, you can't keep up with the atrocities, and it's so shocking. The barbarity of it is so shocking. And, you know, a lot of really smart people, including the South Africans and their legal, you know, the lawyers they had prosecute Israel at the International Court of Justice, have laid out very meticulously the genocidal intent behind this. I mean, Israeli officials have made that incredibly easy because they just openly call for genocide. But sometimes that word doesn't even seem like it's enough. You know what I mean? Like, it's like maybe because we've used it so much, we've heard it so much over the past almost 6 months. It doesn't, I don't know. I mean, genocide's the worst crime you can commit, or it's supposed to be. And maybe that's why it doesn't feel like it's enough, because it's supposed to like provoke a response to stop it from happening. And that hasn't happened. But also it just doesn't even, I mean, this is new. Like, this is so unprecedented. I don't think this has ever happened, where you have these like over 2 million people caged in this ghetto. that's become like essentially a death camp. They don't have anywhere to go. They're killed where they're told to flee to. Their entire families are killed for no reason. Like, it's just, it really, like, you know, it's hard to wrap your head around, like, just how many ways the Israelis are torturing to death the people of Gaza. Like, they're starving them, they're denying them water, and they're bombing them, and it doesn't stop. So I'm just curious your thoughts on the fact that I'm out of words. I don't know if you are.
Well, it's funny that the way that you just described it, that they have nowhere to go, because that's actually what John Kirby said, right? John Kirby said, and this is in, I've been watching these briefings for months, and they're extremely frustrating to watch. What I will say is there are a lot of, because I have a tendency to edit and criticize mainstream like headlines and narratives, but I want to always say there are a lot of journalists who are trying to do their job. They are trying very, very hard to do their jobs. They are pushing back at all of these briefings against all of these officials. And the problem is they're just not getting answers. And you can see the sort of visible frustration. But there was one briefing where, you know, this was sort of brought up. Where do they go? What do they do? Why, if Israel is acting according to the laws of war, then why are so many civilians dying? This question keeps coming up in these briefings. And Kirby said at one point, well, this is a different situation because they have nowhere to go. So this is not something that we're saying. This is something that Biden officials acknowledge. The situation in Gaza is unique because they have nowhere to go. Typically, in a situation of war, which are all horrifying, which all create massive refugee populations, as well as killings within the territories in which people live, usually people have the option to flee. They can become refugees. What's interesting about Gaza is they are already refugees, right? These were people who were already expelled from their homes, not 1,000 years ago, not centuries ago, but who's generationally, you have people in Gaza who are older than the state of Israel. You have people who have keys to their homes that they cannot return to. So they're already refugees. And on top of that, now they have nowhere that they can go. So this is a unique situation. It's not really comparable to other contemporary wars that we have seen. And I mean, in terms of the language, I understand it's you really do feel like you're at a loss of words, because how do you describe something that's happening when so many aspects are happening at the same time? I mean, Gaza is a situation where we are told by US officials that Israel has violated no international law. This is just war. This is the line, right? Here's the thing. If this is just war, then now why is Israel setting so many records for war? Why is it the most journalists that since organizations like Committee to Protect Journalists has existed and recorded this information, why is it the most journalists that have been killed? Why is it the most UN aid workers that have been killed? Why is it the largest cohort of pediatric amputees? Why is it the fastest acceleration of famine that has ever been recorded that we are aware of, right? So how is that happening? How are all of these records being set if this is just war? Daily death tolls, the percentage of the population that has been displaced, all of this is unprecedented. So no, this is not just war. This is not a typical war. This is something that goes well beyond that. And that's why South Africa brought a case. And that's why South Africa said, when you combine the actions on the ground with the language that is being used by Israeli officials, openly using genocidal language, that's what this is. But we're at a loss of words because that word does not seem to push at least the Biden administration and the US to take any action. And I say that because I think the international system, its institutions have worked the way that they're supposed to, right? They are actually trying. What's not allowing them to work is the United States. It's not even Israel. It's the US. And no, it's hard to say that because it's hard to, as an American, as someone sitting in this country, having our tax dollars being used to do this, having our weapons be used to do this, it is very difficult to be in that position. But we have to admit that it is solely the actions of the United States that allows Israel to have this genocidal action take place with absolutely no accountability. The fact that we can state clearly that Israel has committed war crimes, and yet you have US officials standing there saying they see no evidence of it. Every institution has told you they see evidence of it. NGOs, the United Nations, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, there's nothing left. There's nothing that they can do when the most powerful country in the world basically refuses to heed their calls.
Absolutely. I want to get to some of those US spokespeople, but first you also mentioned, you know, how you do criticize the media a lot, and you're pretty legendary at the way you do that. So kudos to you. I mean, I always appreciate, like, whenever there's a horrific New York Times headline, we can always depend on you to say it like it actually is. I mean, it's actually insane. So for those who are just listening, I put up one of Asil's tweets. And this is a New York Times headline that the actual headline says lives ended in Gaza. Like, that was the lives ended. Like, we don't know who ended them. We don't know how many. Like, is it one life? Is it like five lives? Is it 10 lives? So you do this very cool thing where you cross out in red where it's stupid and you write it like it is. So 30,000 Palestinians killed in Gaza rather than lives ended in Gaza. And then even the subheading, and again, I'm doing this for those who are just listening. The subheading from the New York Times here is, since the war started, more than 30,000 people have been killed during Israel's bombardment and invasion. And so, of course, you change it to the correct way it should be worded, which is Israel has killed more than 30,000 people during its bombardment and invasion. I mean, it's almost like there's some editor that they have specifically tasked with, like, making sure the headlines absolve Israel as much as possible. And oftentimes end up even blaming Palestinians for the horrors they're facing. And I mean, you were very generous to say there are journalists trying to do their jobs. And I do appreciate those who, you know, are able to stomach those press briefings and stomach all the lies that they're subjected to every single day that they go and ask, like, why aren't you holding Israel accountable for any of this? But at the same time, you know, I've reached the point where when I look at the mainstream corporate media, I just see pro-genocide media. I know that every individual who works in these institutions is not pro-genocide. In fact, I know that many of them are either chased out or subjected to harassment for trying to push back against the way the coverage has been. But, you know, at this point, there's just been too many atrocities that I feel as though these outlets, these legacy media outlets, are just, like, irredeemable. And so I'm just curious, you know, do you think it's still possible at this point to pressure the media? Do you think there's a shift taking place, or, you know, is it just so entrenched that these editors clearly don't see Palestinians as human beings and just never will?
Well, I think the current editors that are at these outlets, obviously, I mean, if you see Palestinians as human beings, this is not how you write headlines. This is not how you present information. Like, they've made an art out of using the passive voice. It's like, you do not want to. There are headlines that don't even, a lot of headlines that don't even name Israel. They don't say anything about Israel, right? Especially the ones that have to do with famine and starvation in Gaza. They rarely mention that Israel is the cause of the famine and the starvation in Gaza, that it's entirely man-made, right? So you only have that kind of a situation when a population has been dehumanized to the point where you're okay doing that. And I do think that there's, and we've seen this, we've seen stories of internal issues where reporters are getting a lot of pushback and trying to give pushback, where they're saying they're in an environment that is not, that is not really free for them to express themselves or write the things that they want to write. That really tells us something about the idea of having a free press. And that's why I say, look, this when you look at Gaza, the most important thing is what is happening to Palestinians inside of that enclave right now. There's nothing more important than that. There's nothing more important than an unfolding genocide and the starvation of an entire population. But when you take a step back, you also realize that there's so many layers that are really, really terrifying when you look at it. One is the international system, right? One is the idea that this thing that human beings have strived towards for such a long time is being basically decimated. On the American front, there's another concern, which is what's happening here? Like, what happened to having a free press? If you look at the statements from Biden officials, you see the headlines matching whatever the statements of Biden officials are, right? They will not, if Biden officials don't name Israel, the press won't name Israel, not in their headlines. That's not what a free press is. That's what we call a state media, right? Like state-sponsored media, where supposedly in these other states, our adversarial states, authoritarian states, they do not have a free press. And you know, in the West, this is championed as a cornerstone of democracy. And yet, how is a free press operating if it just mimics whatever the state officials are saying, right? If Biden says, I don't believe the numbers that are coming out of Gaza, suddenly the entire language of the press changes around it. That's not the job of the press. The job of the press is to push back when Biden says, I don't believe the numbers. The job of the press is to say, well, okay, let's look at the history. Well, it looks like these numbers are legitimate because they're the numbers that are used by international institutions and they're the numbers that are used by Israel. And it turns out they've pretty much always been accurate. And when they haven't been accurate, it's because they undercount deaths, not overcount them. So that's the job of the press. And we know the danger of what happens when they don't do their job, right? Because in 2003, the press was a huge cheerleader for the invasion of Iraq. Turns out all of it was based on lies. We know this now as a fact. And we're seeing that play out in a very similar way now, the difference being we know they're lying in real time, right? That's the difference. We know they are telling lies in real time. We don't have to wait for them to go somewhere and not find any weapons of mass destruction. They are telling us, don't believe what you see, don't believe what you hear, don't believe your own eyes. Oh, you see 8 trucks that were clearly marked, that were targeted not once, not twice, but 3 times until everyone was dead? That was an accident. It doesn't make any sense. But what I would say in terms of your question on, you know, are they redeemable? I think one thing to keep in mind is people still consume mainstream media, right? There's a lot of, sometimes when I do these headlines, I'll see comments where people will say, nobody watches that anymore. Like nobody reads the New York Times. Like, I wish that was true, but it's not. And yeah, that's why you get polls in the US where half of Americans don't know if more Palestinians have been killed or Israelis. How does that happen? Because of how mainstream media is presenting the information. Because if you just looked at headlines, if you're not following this every day, right? If you're not reading about what's happening every day, if you're not reading the details, then your consumption of information is very superficial. And when it's, and that's why the headlines are so important. Because when people are consuming superficial amounts of information, simply because they don't have time to become experts in the field of everything that's going on in the world, that information is falsely presented and that creates false narratives in their minds. So Americans end up not knowing basic facts on the ground. That's not their fault. That's the fault of the media. And that is what they're consuming. So that's why it's important to push back on them. We can't just say, you know, throw our hands in the air and say, well, nobody really pays attention to this anymore. They do. And it affects the way that the population thinks. And that's why it's A, important to push back. And B, I think it's important to continue having these conversations, encouraging people to look at more independent media. The other part of it is it's corporate media. So how can you actually pressure them? Money, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have subscriptions, if these are paid subscriptions, cancel them, right? Do things that actually affect the way that corporate media is affected, because really the only thing they understand is their pocketbooks, right? If that is what's affected, then maybe that pushback will lead to some kind of change. And we have seen, by the way, headlines get edited after backlash. Still not great editing, but but that means that something is being triggered, right? Something is affecting it, because I think especially for a lot of the people, the journalists themselves that are working there, I don't think most of these people went to school and went into this field of work because they wanted to defend genocide or basically your entire reputation for your life will be tarnished. That's it. Your legacy in life will be that you defended a genocide. And I think that a lot of them do not want that. So I think keep pushing back, putting pressure where there's a possibility of putting economic pressure, put that and really force them to have to tell the truth, because that's all anybody is asking for, the truth.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have said that better. And I do, you know, really appreciate that you are able to consume what you do, because I just can't. But you're right. Like, so many people watch CNN, and not even because they're turning it on. You know, if you go to any airport in the US, any hotel, any like restaurant that has televisions, CNN is literally force fed like down your throat as though it's state media. So it is important to continue to push back and to continue to pressure them. Now I want to move on to the topic of US spokespeople, which you did bring up. And that's something else that I can't always stomach, though sometimes I try to. I mean, you know, for some reason yesterday, I felt compelled to watch the press conferences by, I think it was that woman, Sabrina, at the Pentagon. John Kirby gave a press conference at the White House. And then there was, you know, the Daily Matt Miller theatrical performance. And you know, you recently tweeted out, "I'm so tired of Biden officials acting like we're idiots. You can't arm and fund Israel, draw no red lines, veto UN resolutions, reject the ICJ, cut UNRWA funding, ignore international law, then say you're helping the dire humanitarian crisis you created. People see your lies." And I think that's really important, because these people that I just mentioned, Matt Miller and John Kirby, I mean, their job is literally to get up every day and go lie about a genocide. And it's always the same talking points. It's always, "Well, the Israelis told us they're investigating." You guys, we can't get ahead of the investigation. They're really big on not wanting to get ahead of the investigation. They repeat that a lot. And then there's the whole, you know,
to leave the news cycle.
Yeah. That's what. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, that you're absolutely right. That must be it. Because I noticed that yesterday, because there was three different people doing three different press conferences, and they all just read the same thing, like over and over again. Because yeah, they want to hammer home that point. But it's just at this point, it's an insult to our intelligence that these people get up and say what they say. But I guess I'm just curious your, you know, reaction to these the sort of like vile, parasitic nature of the jobs of people like Matt Miller, and you know what it means for us in particular. Well, I don't live in the US right now, but I am American. What it means for us to be from a country, to live in a country that just spends every day justifying the most horrific atrocities, making excuses for them, lying about them, and then like acting as though we're some sort of democracy because we have paid liars to tell the press, no, it's fine, guys.
I mean, I think I tweeted that out of pure frustration, because it is rage inducing to listen to. I'm telling you, I've been listening to these briefings for months, and the way they answer questions, not only do you see the sort of stale responses that make no sense, you actually see the agitation they have, as if like, "Why are you pushing back on me? Like, I've told you this is the case. This is to journalists," right? And I think what's especially frustrating that it's the Biden administration is that, wasn't this the administration that criticized their predecessors for talking about, you know, for basically disparaging the media? Now, does Biden or Biden officials take the same language? No. But essentially, they're treated the same way, right? As soon as there's pushback, as soon as they say, "Well, how can you say that Israel has not violated in these 6 months, Israel has not violated international law at any point," and you see the frustration and the agitation from these officials. I think we talked about the international system and the shattering of the international system and international law. Similarly, U.S. credibility was not something that was, you know, potent before. It's not like the U.S. had a lot of credibility going into this situation. It did not. For rightfully so, because the U.S. has acted, you know, like Western double standards, the hypocrisy, all of that is baked into the system as it exists, because all of it is rooted in colonialism and imperialism, right? When we think about colonialism, people, I don't know what people assume, right? I don't know if they assume the language of a colonialist was, "You're a savage, I'm going to take all of your stuff and kill you." That's not what anybody ever said. They did say, "You're a savage," but they said, "You're a savage, I'm going to help you. That's why we're here. We're not here to murder all of you and take your land and take your resources and exploit your labor. we're here to help you because you're savages, right? So the language of colonialism has always been one of benevolence, has always been one of superiority and benevolence, right? So we are the superior group, but we're so kind, we're going to bestow our, you know, ways of life on you so that you can be civilized like we are. Essentially, this is the same language that we're still hearing, right? Those are the roots of where this frustration comes from. Is you're clearly acting with double standards, but the level to which we're seeing it now is brazen in a different way, right? I didn't expect the Biden administration to come in and be great on foreign policy. That was never my expectation. Did I expect this? No. I think Biden has exceeded all of our expectations in terms of just how far he will go to defend the actions of Israel. And that is defending a genocide. I mean, he tweeted yesterday a statement, finally being outraged by something because of the death of 7 aid workers, because they were killed by Israel. And then on the same day, there's headlines in the New York Times and CNN about the Biden administration pushing for an $18 billion arms deal to sell Israel bombs and fighter jets. So this is like, when I say the amount of hypocrisy, it's just ridiculous. And when they're asked about that in the press briefing, this question has come up. Well, why, you know, how do we justify the transfer of weapons to Israel right now? And the response from the State Department is, well, these are deals that go back years, right? This is how they try to sort of trick you, make you feel like you're stupid, and say things like, well, you know, this isn't even about now. This is something we agreed to years ago. And so you actually had, again, journalists in the room say, but you have the option not to, right? You're acting like that means you have no choice. But the U.S. has the authority to, not only did the U.S. have the authority, the U.S. has the responsibility according to U.S. domestic law. So even if we didn't believe in international law, apparently we don't believe in our own laws anymore either. So to me, what these officials are doing, which I don't think they have the foresight to understand what they're doing, they are paving the way, not only for a second Trump administration, but for that administration to take this shredding of domestic law, this shredding of international law, to really any level that they want. Because once you've destroyed that system, what's the next step? I think it's incredible that there was so much criticism of the Trump administration, rightfully so, but that the Biden administration has almost taken that further and made it even worse. So yeah, these officials, I don't know what they're thinking, but in my mind, their legacy will be those, history will record them as defenders of genocide and really nothing else.
No, definitely. I mean, it's really, I mean, yes. Okay. Like, am I surprised that Joe Biden loves Israel and wants to like hug it so tight and give it a bajillion weapons? No, I still couldn't have guessed he was going to do this. He was going to oversee a genocide and not just oversee like what's taking place right now in Gaza, but also like let Israel rampage across the region and potentially drag the U.S. into a regional war that the Americans clearly don't want. I mean, that does seem to be the one thing that this administration does care about, is not having a bigger war with Iran where it has to like get involved. But it's not doing anything to actually prevent that. And, you know, you were talking about the fact that we keep being told that, you know, on the one hand, they want humanitarian aid to get in, but then we find out they're giving more, even if the aid workers are killed, they've approved more F-35s to Israel. And then just last week, you know, it was, we were hearing on and on, they don't want a Rafah operation. They don't want a Rafah operation. But then you have this article from the Washington Post, the Biden administration in recent days quietly authorized the transfer of billions of dollars in bombs and fighter jets to Israel, despite Washington's concerns about an anticipated military offensive in southern Gaza that could threaten the lives of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian civilians. Moreover, like it talks, the article goes on to talk about the 2,000-pound bombs that the Americans will be sending for the Israelis to essentially use in Rafah. So like, on the one hand, you don't want them to do A, but then you're giving them all of the tools to do it. And then we're all just supposed to like be idiots and believe that you really don't want a Rafah operation. But I think more importantly, you know, something you talk about in the piece that you wrote is the fact that there is a lot Biden can do. I mean, they are doing a lot. They are continuing to arm Israel. They're continuing to, like, you know, block attempts at an actual ceasefire, all of these things. But there's actually, they kind of just shrug their shoulders and act like there's nothing they can do. But they actually can do a lot. They can do everything. Like, it's all in their hands to stop Israel. So can you lay some of that out? Like, ideally, what could the Biden administration do to stop what's happening in Gaza?
Well, this connects to the previous question about the Biden officials and speaks to this question. It is genuine. I mean, people in the briefing room have laughed because they've made comments when Matthew Miller says Israel is a sovereign state. We can't tell Israel what to do, just like we can't tell any sovereign state what to do. And there was one briefing where Associated Press reporter Matt Lee basically responded and said, unless we invade them. And Matthew Miller, who's the State Department spokesperson, laughed, like cackled at this comment because it is that ridiculous, because his statement is that ridiculous. Like, we don't tell sovereign states what to do. We only tell sovereign states what to do. We exclusively tell sovereign states what to do. We do it through military occupations and invasions. We do it even when we're not even when we don't have boots on the ground. We'll just bomb countries, right? We'll just bomb Yemen when we feel like, well, you're not doing something that we want, so we're just going to bomb you. I thought you can't do that to sovereign countries. And then when the military isn't an option, we sanction them to death, right? So no, there's a lot of things we do to sovereign countries all the time. So I can't tell if I'm going crazy or if does everybody see it? I'm like, what? But everybody does. But I mean, people who are privy to this see it. For a US official to say, we can't tell sovereign states what to do. Here's the thing. No one's asking you to dictate to a sovereign state what to do. I agree with that. We cannot dictate or impose our will on sovereign states. We can, however, tell sovereign states that they have to abide by international law. No one is telling the US administration to force Israel to do something that is not within the charter of international law. We're just saying if they are not following international law, then just like in any other situation that you take action, what is the action that you can take? So what can the Biden administration do? I mean, it's a laundry list of things that it can do, but it can start with allowing the international system to work. It can start by just doing that. It doesn't even if it did nothing else, it could just stop vetoing resolutions. And then when it abstains, pretending that resolutions are not non-binding, right? Mm-hmm. It can stop undermining the international system and allow it to do its job. That's the first thing it can do. The second thing, well, and part of that would be supporting the ICJ, right? The world's highest court, actually pretending like it's supposed to be meaningful rather than it's only meaningful when it's against Russia. But then when it's against Israel, we reject all authority. We reject all its findings, right? We'll provide evidence if we're the United States for those exact courts, the ICC, the ICJ, in order to prosecute Russia. But when they want to prosecute Israel, we reject it outright, right? So let them do their jobs. The next thing that they can do, stop providing weapons. Stop providing Israel with the ammunition that it is using, with the 2,000-pound bombs that it is using in Gaza. That is where these weapons are being used. Right? Stop saying it's meant for Iran. That's not where it's being used. It's being used in Gaza right now. So again, this idea that Israel's security is an issue for the United States, even if you take that position at its word, the question is, as long as Israel is using these weapons in Gaza, you don't allow them to have it. As soon as they stop using it in Gaza, fine. You know, it's up to this administration. You can resume weapons transfers. If actually you care about what's happening in Gaza, you can make them, and this word for whatever reason is very problematic for them, conditional. Conditional. They are not allowed to use them in Gaza. If they do, they're cut off. Cut off military aid, right? Maybe stop giving billions of US tax dollars to Israel in order for Israel to carry out atrocities and use those billions of dollars to actually help Americans at home. Right? None of these, by the way, are punitive measures. Nothing is punitive about what I said. It's just, we're going to stop giving you gifts. So the narrative is so reversed that just saying we're going to stop giving you our stuff is apparently a punishment. It's not. What is actually punishment? What are punitive measures that the US can take? Targeted sanctions, right? Not, and I say this as someone who is often opposed to US sanctions, not broad-based sanctions that will collapse the entire economy of Israel and act as collective punishment against the civilian population of Israel. Not that. Not what I'm talking about. Targeted sanctions. Actually saying that there's some kind of accountability for Israel. Lead the international community, not unilateral sanctions, the international community to put international sanctions, which are contingent upon Israel's actions under international law, right? That's what these systems are meant to do. I have never suggested U.S. military, like a military intervention, because I don't think that that works anywhere. And so I would never suggest it in this situation either. But if the U.S. actually took any of those actions, supported the international system, first of all, Europe would never, most of Europe would follow whatever the U.S. did. Minus, honestly, ironically, maybe Germany, being the only one that would be so fervent about its support for Israel that it might not fall into line. But the UK, France, other countries in Europe, which are already sort of pushing back some of them against the US position, if the US did that, they would also fall into line. And obviously that is the position of the overwhelming international community. So there's all sorts of levers that the Biden administration can use, and they simply refuse to do so. How about this? Stop undermining the numbers of people who've been killed. Stop lying and saying they haven't committed any war crimes or violated international law. It's just there's so much that they can do that they refuse to do. And what I think is that if the US refuses to do so, we focus the international community on Israel. But the international community can censor the US as well. And it should, because this state is individually not allowing the system to operate. And it is a threat to that very order. It doesn't matter that it's championed the cause for so long, rhetorically. Through its actions, it is shattering that system. So if they want it to exist, then something has to happen where the US is kept in check. And if it doesn't work, then yeah, we need to... The international community is not just the United States. There's billions of people in the world, hundreds of countries, and they need to figure out... We need to figure out as a global community, how do we address issues of fundamental human rights, averting wars that hurt civilian populations, as well as addressing global issues like climate change, like pandemics when they happen, like nuclear proliferation. These are things that will affect everyone, no matter what border you're in. And that's why we need these international institutions. But if the US shatters them to protect Israel, then we're left with nothing.
It also shows what a threat to humanity the US is. And in so many ways, you know, sometimes I actually genuinely believe that what is being done in Gaza is meant to terrify the world. I mean, when you look around, like, I absolutely agree with everything you said, but then you look at the lengths to which, I'm not even talking about the Israelis here, I'm talking about the Americans, the length to which American officials are willing to destroy and shatter actual people in Gaza, and justify it and continue to fund and arm it. And it's almost like it's a performance for everybody else. Like, this is what we're capable of. And I really do, I do believe, and you see some of the rhetoric of other leaders in the global South, they look at this and they get scared. Like, oh, this is what they'll do. That this is the extent they're willing to go to get their way. Like, they'll commit a genocide to get their way. And I really, it's like, it's mafia behavior on like a global scale. And it really is quite frightening. But, you know, on that note, I want to ask you, you know, I never had any illusions about the Democratic Party. I don't think you did either. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong. I think we may have touched on this when we talked in the past, but you know, this just seems so extreme. Like, I do often ask myself, was this always who they were? And we're just kind of like seeing them in a mask off moment right now. Or is this something new? I'm not entirely sure. Like, I guess it maybe is who they always were, but this just seems so extreme. And there's so few people opposing it. Like, you even had that Obama-Biden event of like last week, and these people protested it. And Obama was so incredibly rude to the protester and like was just like, you gotta listen. We know what we're doing, basically. And it's like, are you people just all sociopaths? Like, I don't even know how to like understand the rationality behind this from people who claim to like, I don't know, care a little bit about pretending to care about human rights.
Well, the sort of audacity of Obama's statement of you can't, well, it was something to the effect of you can't just talk, you have to listen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why do I say it's audacious? The world has been shouting, screaming, crying out to the US for months to listen. And the US refuses to do so. Right? So the idea that someone would say the protesters are actually the ones who are echoing what the overwhelming international community is saying. So first, our institutions, our government is not listening to the entire world. So there's that. On top of that, though, the audacity in a democratic system to say, you need to listen. It's like, no, actually, you need to listen. Because this is supposed to be, supposedly, this is what I was always told growing up in this country. I was told that it is a government for, of, and by the people, right? I'm getting it mixed up, but you know what I mean, right? This is supposed to be a government that is made up of its own people and carries out the will of those people. So it is the job of our elected officials to listen to their constituents, not the other way around. So just the sheer audacity was one of the things that stuck out to me in that particular incident. But in terms of, you know, were they always like this? Is this a mask off moment? I think what I would say, and I say this both of the Democratic and the Republican Party, and I would say this overall of the sort of atmosphere, not only in the US, but you see this across the world. When Trump became president, there was a lot of people who would make comments like, oh, now all the racists kind of come out, right? They were always racist and now they're just showing, right, mask off. And I pushed back against that a little bit because I said, look, it's not, people change, right? Like we are not, as any individual human being can attest to, you are not who you were 10 years ago. You will not be the same person 10 years from now that you are today. Right. And events, contexts, as they change, can make you actually change. And I think what you see, why you see these global movements towards the poles of left and right. Right. It's not just sort of right wing fascism. And we talk, the Democratic Party talks about this a lot in the US, the fear of right wing fascism in the US. But you're seeing it in Europe. You're seeing it in Israel. You're seeing it even in, you know, Iran is an example of a country that has just moved further and further to the right, consolidating power around the ultra conservative hardliners in the country. Right. So you're seeing the consolidation of power amongst these like mafia groups and all these different countries. What's the underlying thing? Why is this happening? I think you have a system that has failed most of humanity in that you have mass wealth inequality. People, and this is in the US and this is in all these other places, governments want their citizens to take the burden of that with austerity measures constantly, while elites are completely protected from any of that. They just get wealthier and wealthier while the masses get poorer and poorer. So there's a lot of dissatisfaction. People don't trust their governments when they're dissatisfied. And so you saw that again in the US during the COVID pandemic. Like, why was it that other countries in the world were begging for vaccines and Americans were just like, oh, we don't want it. Out of protest, we're not going to take our free, available, that the US hoarded vaccines. We're not going to take them because they don't trust the government. And this, you see it in other countries as well. So I think it's not just that they were always like this. I think that it's, they also get sort of swept up in certain contexts and situations. I don't know that the Barack Obama of today is the same Barack Obama whose books I read in the early 2000s. You know, it's a little cynical to think this is just who they were all along. They were just deceiving you. I think they've become this way. The more they have access to power and the more that power is unchecked, I think that's one of the issues too. Power has become completely unchecked. There's nothing to sort of, and so sometimes in history, we see these mass horrible events, right? Mass horrifying events that sort of reset things, right? That's what World War I was supposed to be, the war to end all wars. We founded the League of Nations, that failed. And so then we had World War II. And so the entire international system was founded in the wake of this horrific event that cost tens of millions of lives globally. In a way, I see what's happening in Gaza as being a similar kind of horrifying event that might be, and I don't know this, but it might be the reset, right? It might be the thing that forces people to your point because you're so scared. Like if these countries are okay with the mass slaughter of children, starving, knowingly starving children, like this isn't a natural disaster. There is a truck 10 minutes away that can feed that child and it's not being allowed in. So crazy. If this can be allowed to happen, then anything can be allowed to happen. And if that's the case, then, you know, yeah, we need to rethink things and reassess things. But I think it's not just a matter of this is who they've always been. I think things have gotten worse and they have matched that context by becoming worse themselves.
Well, I just want to point out that we have an election, or remind everybody, we do have an election coming up in November. And look, I know that Republicans are more overtly racist. There's no question. They are more hateful. But Democrats might not have that same rhetoric, but they are overseeing a genocide and contributing to that hate as well. And I just want to play a clip of... this is the one I want to play, of Hillary Clinton recently addressing people who are dissatisfied with Biden. Here we go. Just let's go ahead and listen to what Hillary Clinton had to say.
But it's Biden versus Trump. Yes, we know that.
It is.
What do you say to voters who are upset that those are the two choices?
Get over yourself. Those are the two choices.
Yeah, love that.
Right? And you know, it's kind of like, one is old and effective and compassionate, has a heart and really cares about people. And one is old and has been charged with 91 felonies.
Yeah, okay.
I mean.
Okay, interesting.
I don't understand why this is even a hard choice, really. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
But we have to go through the election and hopefully people will realize what's at stake because it's an existential question. What kind of country we're going to have, what kind of democracy we're going to have. And people who blow that off are not paying attention because it's not like Trump, his enablers, his empowerers, his allies are not telling us what they want to do. I mean, they're pretty clear about what kind of country they want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Get out there and vote.
So, God, there's so much I could say about that. Your thoughts on that attitude. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear the rest, you can access it by becoming a Breakthrough News member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews.